Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is July 25th, and we have today Rob Arnott and Ira Harris and Judd Hirschberg. Rob is founder and chairman of the board of Research Affiliates. He plays an active role in the firm's research, portfolio management, product innovation, business strategy, and client-facing activities. He's also a co-portfolio manager on several PIMCO funds. Research Affiliates is a research-intensive asset management firm intent on delivering innovative and impactful products and insights. And Rob has published more than 150 articles in various publications. Ira is a past hedge fund manager, global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He's also served as CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also a stint there most recently. We also have Judd Hirschberg, chief technical strategist of White Wave Trading Strategies, joining us to provide technical charts relating to specific asset classes being discussed. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks for having me. This is another great honor sitting with Rob. So,
thank you so much.
We're almost the same age. I'm a little bit older, I think.
Yeah,
he looks better because he's been in California.
It's tough being an old fart.
Okay, I thought we'd begin, Rob, with your global macro view on the economy and the financial markets.
Well, firstly, the financial markets are opportunity-rich environment today. And by that, I don't mean chase the Mag 7. What I mean is the dispersion in valuations is absolutely enormous. You have the Russell Growth Index priced at upwards of a 50 Shiller PE ratio. You have emerging markets value priced at almost exactly 10 on a Shiller PE ratio basis. Do you want an earnings yield of 2.25 or an earnings yield of 10? You get paid awfully well to be patient in markets that are cheap. And the dispersion in valuations in the fixed income arena are also very, very wide. The developed markets, 10-year government bonds are priced lower than U.S. 10 years, materially lower. And emerging markets debt is priced at a yield that's comparable to that of U.S. junk bonds. So the dispersion in valuations is tremendous. We're in an opportunity-rich environment. We have a website called Asset Allocation Interactive that provides our capital markets expectations for 160 different asset classes. And we're long-term investors. If somebody asked me what stock should I buy, or do you think the market's going up or down next quarter, I don't have a clue. And people who say they know what's coming don't. But if you're looking at 10-year returns, it's shockingly easy to get a reasonably accurate handle on 10-year returns, and getting people to shift their focus from recent past returns to long-term future returns is a challenge. But our work on long-term future returns suggests Russell Growth is priced to give you about 1.5% per annum, emerging markets value about 10.5 to 11. EFA value not far behind, about 9.5, and U.S. value not far behind that, about 8. So you can get 8 on per annum for the next 10 years on U.S. large cap value, and you can get 1.5 on chasing the Mag 7. Now, how accurate are these numbers? They sound like they're pulled out of thin air. Basically, returns in markets are earned in yield. What do you get back per year? Growth, how fast does that income grow? And changes in valuation multiples, or in the bond arena, changes in spreads. Those are the three engines for return. Very, very simple. and shockingly easy to forecast. If you take the historical long-term growth in income, it's not a bad proxy for the future. If you have the current yield, well, that's a very, very good proxy for the current yield. And if you want to look at estimates of changing valuation multiples, US is at a Shiller PE ratio, price relative to 10-year smoothed earnings, of about 36. The long-term historic norm is about 18. Are we projecting that we're going to mean revert back to 18? No, we're not. We're acknowledging that that could happen. And so maybe this is a new normal. Maybe 10 years from now, you'll still be at 36. Maybe you'll mean revert to 18. Let's split the difference. Let's say you go from 36 to 27. You take your time at it. It takes 10 years to get there. That pulls down your returns by about 3% a year. Yield, not even 1.5%. Long-term historical growth, little under 4.5. Half of that's inflation, half of that's real growth. Wall Street says, don't worry about the 1% yield. We're going to give you 18% growth. Come on. History suggests 4 or 5. Four and change plus 1 and change gives you 5.5 or 6. Do people buy the S&P 500 expecting to make 5.5 or 6? No, they don't. Their expectations are way above that. But a reasonable expectation is 5.5 or 6. And take mean reversion out of the picture, just a partway mean reversion that's patient and takes 10 years would shave that back by 3 to get you a little bit under 3. So we're expecting just under 3 for S&P 500, 1.5 for Russell growth, and reciprocally about 5 for Russell value. Like I said, it's an opportunity-rich environment. We've gone back 50 years and tested our capital markets expectations methodology. And on average, the forecasted 10-year return is within about 2%. So if we're projecting 3.5, as likely as not, it'll be between 1.5 and 5.5. Do people buy stocks expecting that kind of return? No.
Interesting. And views on the macroeconomy, in terms of the inflation or what the tariffs effects could be?
Sure.
Yeah.
I was at a conference recently where Robert Lighthizer was one of the speakers. And Lighthizer is caricatured as some right-wing MAGA lunatic. He's actually very, this is the first time I'd seen him speak other than just sound bites on TV. And he gave very thoughtful, very insightful observations. He was asked during Q&A, you guys are telling us that tariffs won't cause inflation. And why do you say that? And he said, we're not saying that. We're saying tariffs won't cause lasting inflation. Imports are only about 10% of the U.S. economy. So what's the upside risk of tariffs? Maybe a 1% one-off blip. Not a big deal. And personally, I've been very amused at Wall Street spending countless millions trying to model the impact of tariffs on inflation, on GDP, on unemployment, on interest rates. Lighthizer said the problem with these models is that they're useless. Empirically, they don't work. And if they don't work, why are people paying any attention to them? I would go a step further and say they're only useful if you know what the tariffs are going to be next year and the year after. I don't think Trump knows what they're going to be next week.
Right.
Yeah. So that being the case, why model this? What you can model is that policy, volatile policy, can lead to volatile markets. Policy uncertainty can lead to volatile markets. So model that, and what you come up with is market uncertainty is elevated, not necessarily severely, but market uncertainty is elevated. Lighthizer closed by saying, tariffs will boost costs, but we don't know by how much. We don't know how much is borne by the producers of the product, by the shippers, by the retailers, and then eventually by the consumer. And we also know that higher prices for imports lead to reduced demand for imports and increased demand for domestic product, which means that that impact of inflationary impact is overstated. So it was a very well-reasoned response, not the knee-jerk MAGA tariffs have absolutely no impact nonsense. I thought it was fascinating. But my macroeconomic outlook is we're going to see a recession sometime in the next 3 to 5 years. That's a forecast I'd comfortably make in almost any year. Will it happen this year or next year or the year after or the year after that? I don't know. Are there recessionary pressures as a consequence of the tariffs? Not so much here, but potentially in our trade counterparties. Now, is that one of the reasons that those markets are so cheap relative to the US? Of course it is. Prices in markets are set based on narratives. Narratives have the advantage of being largely true most of the time. They have the disadvantage of being 100% reflected in current share prices. So narratives are useless for investing unless you find areas where the narratives are wrong and or are have odds of being wrong. I love asymmetric bets where there's a narrative and the asymmetric risk. Let's take tariffs. The narrative was for a while, oh my God, these tariffs are huge. They're going to be massively recessionary. They're going to be massively inflationary. And on Lighthizer's analysis, and I came to a very similar conclusion using very similar logic, on Lighthizer's analysis, yeah, there's an inflationary risk, but it's a one-off, it's temporary. Yeah, there's a recessionary risk, but it's tiny and it affects more those that are on the other side of the tariffs than it affects us. And so the asymmetry is a little bit of inflationary risk, a little bit of macroeconomic risk, and the possibility that inflation will come in much lower than people expect than the narrative, and the economy will be stronger than the narrative. So I come at this and view modest narratives as a non-issue, and huge huge tariffs as a cudgel that Trump uses to bludgeon people to do what he wants them to do. So one of the things about Trump that I think is just fascinating is in college, his favorite book was Sun Tzu's Art of War. This is well known. And yet, as he came into office, you ask 100 Wall Street pundits, have you read Art of War recently? You'd be lucky to have one or two of them say yes. Have you read Art of War ever? You'd be lucky to have 10 out of 100 say yes. This guy's practically memorized Art of War, and it's been his lifelong MO. And so you want to understand Trump, read Art of War. When he won, I sent a note to my leadership team saying, please read Art of War. 2 weeks later, I asked, and none of them had. And so I asked ChatGPT, please prepare a summary of Art of War. Okay. And it came out with this beautiful 1,000-word summary, elegant, beautifully done. I mean, AI is awesome. And I sent that 1,000-word summary around, and I said, okay, now this is required reading.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Oh, that's, yeah, very interesting. And lots of good observation points. Do you, Ira, what are your thoughts? Do you align?
Well, it's not that whether I align or not. So in regards to Mr. Lighthizer, who I have great respect for, like Rob does, but I know he's got a, you know, he took a gig at Citibank, but from everything that Rob says, now we know who Trump really talks to. Because the Lighthizer will beat on him going, don't worry about the, and that's why he goes, and then he goes after Powell, because he goes, what are you worried about inflation for? Yeah, but Powell has a consensus organization that he has to deal with a preponderance of labor economists, by the way. And nobody is more wrong about more things than labor economists.
Yeah.
Because by training and knowledge base, they always lean toward the moral side, which is how do I get less unemployment? And that's, from a moral standpoint, they're 100% right. From a financial economic standpoint, and what your the philosophers, what you ought to be concerned with is the soundness of the currency and the stability of the currency and maintaining it as a store of value. I mean, that's just my view, and very libertarian in nature, because I lean that way in most things. But so we know that Trump is, and Lighthizer was on his first team, and Lighthizer is a heavyweight, because don't forget, he worked under one of the best. Whether I couldn't stand him as a person, Jim Baker, but when Jim Baker walked in a room, you trembled. And you didn't tremble just because he was the Secretary of Treasury, he was the Chief of Staff. He had a phenomenal intellect, and he was had a way of arguing to get his views accepted. So Lighthizer learned under him. And you know, nothing says it more than the Plaza Accord and the Louvre Accord. Not that they were the being and end all, but they were phenomenal political agreements in a very difficult time. I think more difficult than they are now, by the way.
Yeah.
It was interesting that Trump was out this morning. I don't have the quotes in front of me, but he was talking about the Japanese and the Chinese and availing themselves of a weak currency to better themselves, which is the first time we've heard him talk about currencies probably since 2017, when he held that meeting at the White House with all the CEOs, and Mark Field famously came out, and when they interviewed him, he said, currency manipulation is the mother of all trade barriers. Of course, he had a very short life as CEO of Ford, but it was an interesting thing. And we have not heard currencies. In fact, going back to what Rob talked about, when people started, were talking about the tariffs and the April 2nd date, or I mean,
Liberation Day.
Richard, huh?
Yeah, Liberation.
Liberation Day. You and I on these podcasts talked about, I'm arguing with people, I said, everything that they're doing is bearish the dollar, and everybody was bullish the dollar. In other words, you couldn't read an analysis from a Wall Street economist that didn't talk the dollar was going up. I go, yeah. No, I don't see that at all. In fact, if the dollar goes up, you're undoing what you want to do with the tariffs anyway. So I was not a part of that argument. But interesting today, Trump comes out and mentions currency. So I want to see where this goes, because that, in speaking of what Rob talks about, in seeking value, and I'm a value seeker, but my value comes from analyzing the underlying fundamentals and then going to search for what I think are good value proposition. I mean, Richard, we all during COVID, what did we talk about? Foreign banks. Yeah, the U.S. banks have done well, but I shifted my money after the first leg up to buy UBS, to buy Commerce Bank, because Commerce Bank to me had a niche. If Europe was ever going to have a capital markets union, they were a really cheap asset. I still love Tokyo Mitsubishi. The Japanese banks to me are very interesting. So these have been done very well. And yes, and I love when Rob says it, they're not mag stocks, but they've gone up 300 or 400% or more without that volatility.
Right.
And who can, you know, when everybody talks about how much they've gained, what type of volatilities did you have to sit through? Yeah, you know, I sat through the dot-com bubble. I mean, I didn't sit through it. I traded through it and came to understand what real risk was when you're really residing in a mania. You know, I go back to Kindleberger, who probably wrote one of the best books. I love all the guys who come out of MIT and cite Kindleberger, but yet, just like Sun Tzu, very few of the mathematical model builders really have paid attention to Kindleberger. Right, that's just not. So now I think we're at a good jump off point. So I'll be interested to see where Rob wants to go.
Yeah, the use of models is relatively new in economics and finance. By relatively new, I mean the last 75 years. I was at one conference where a former vice chair of the ECB was one of the speakers, and I said, this was during the period of ZERP. I said to him, how does this policy relate to Knut Wicksell's natural rate of interest? And I said, if the rate of interest is below the natural rate, you are stimulating bubbles. You are encouraging stupid use of money because you're making it too easy for those who can borrow at that rate to borrow at that rate. And if the rate of money is above the natural rate, you're putting the brakes on the economy. It's a speed bump. If there's no speed bump, there will be some reckless driving. If the speed bump's too high, you stop traffic cold. And he said, anything before 1937 is irrelevant. And I thought, forgive my language, holy shit, you've got to be kidding me. Adam Smith is irrelevant. Basquiat is irrelevant. Wicksell's irrelevant. The list goes on and on and on. Before Keynes, it was called political economy, because it was a matter of the interplay of political policy and the performance of the macroeconomy. And then it became mathematical economy. I was a triple major in college, and one of my degrees was mathematical economics. But extremely simple problem. If you think models are the reality, and reality is dismissed when it disagrees with the models, you've got a problem. George Box famously made the observation, all models are wrong, some models are useful. And I love that saying, because it really distills the problem with an over-reliance on models. Look at the real world. Look at the outliers that don't fit your model. See what you can learn from them. By the same token, as an investor, look at your mistakes and see what you can learn from them.
Yeah. Well, it's like when I used to be on with Rick Santelli all the time, we used to talk about, I said, you know, the problem with the modelers, they want to believe that it's rocket science, but it's not rocket science. I mean, I grew up, as you grew up, watching the space capsules come down within a 3-mile radius of a Navy ship in the middle of the Pacific, for the most part. That was rocket science.
Yeah.
When you take economics can't get within a 300-mile, and I'm being kind, you know, yeah. I said, because they can never do it, and yet they, see, I think you're right. Certain models do good, you know, they can be really good aggregators of data. They're just miserable forecasters, because again, tell me the assumptions you're building into your model. Let me take it. And no, we don't want to share that. I mean, I left graduate school because I was studying political economy in at the University of Wisconsin. That's what I was doing. It's multinational corporations. It was right after the fall of Bretton Woods. I'm in that age group. And yeah. It was political economy. And I had some great, great teachers who taught. Who I learned from the same people, the Austrian school and Marx. And when you really go back to that period, the Marxist economists understood the negative repercussions of the recycling of the OPEC dollars far better than everybody else. The Wall Street people and the free, you know, those who are more free market oriented, they only looked at it as the money circulated. But the Marxists were really all on top of it, going, you're setting yourself up here. And when I went for my first bank interviews, because I said, well, maybe I'll go to work at a, and I would explain this to them, and they go, this is the greatest lending we're doing. Plain and simple. This is, we are making money hand over fist. They said, you're no use to us. Yeah. So as I say, when Continental Bank, because I'm from Chicago, when Continental Bank, and that was one of the ones I went to interview, when it went under, I had a lot of TED spreads on that day. I was already 5-6 years into trading, and I had, and then somebody said, let's go play golf. I go, no, I have to watch this and see this through as the TED spreads were exploding. I said, okay, we're good now. Yeah. And but guys, I see it really well with you.
Yeah. It's a fun business we're in, isn't it?
It can be.
Even when it's going haywire, it can be fun. One of the things that this is going to sound weird. One of the things I enjoy immensely is when I make a mistake. I'll give an example. Liberation Day. I reasoned that the narrative is that these are going to be big tariffs and people are scared. And once they become announced and reality, the unease will dissipate and markets are likely to rise. So when the tariffs were being announced, I was buying S&P futures. I got creamed for 2 days. I lightened the positions and then I put them back on a few days later. And if you make a mistake, what do you learn from your mistake? I was projecting my expectations as a market consensus. I was expecting big tariffs. The market was expecting 10-20% across the board. And I didn't do my homework. And so anyway, it was hair-raising ride for a few days, but if you learn from mistakes, it's wonderful.
I raised my kids trying to explain to them that every day I'm wrong out of seven out of every 10, eight out of every 10, maybe 10 out of 10 are wrong. But again, it's what we learn from. And a couple of weeks ago, we did a podcast with Kevin Duffy, and he kept talking about skating to where the puck is going to be.
Right.
Right. But I said to him, yes, that's why I do all my work and try to project where it's going to be. But as a trader, a good trader, and on your day of it, we could see where the puck was going to be, but we got caught off sides.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, that's exactly. And that's what you strive. And if you're going to be aggressive like you were, and I can certainly be, you're going to be off sides at times. It's to minimize your losses when you are offside.
Yes. And this is a graph of what happened those days. Thank you.
Yeah. the models you mentioned, Rob, like notwithstanding the limitations, as you mentioned on the models or tools, Research Affiliates has those tools you can go to and play around. What are those showing now in terms of like trends, short term to medium term? Are they saying like outperformance of value versus growth equities, for example, or precious metals, emerging markets? Maybe which specific emerging markets?
The markets are obsessed with short to intermediate term outlook. And so that's not where we can add value. We feel we can add value on long term. And so this is a situation where Ira and I are in different domains. My bet on S&P futures was a short-term bet, but that wasn't on client money. Ira, you do a lot of...
I know about that, yeah.
You do a lot of short-term trading. I focus on the long-term because I view volatility as our friend. I have a plaque on my desk. I have two places, one Miami Beach and the other Newport Beach. And in my Miami Beach office, I have a plaque that came from John Templeton's desk that says trouble is opportunity. And basically, when you have a shock, tariffs of 30, 50, 60%, and the market was expecting 10 or 20, it creates opportunity. It disrupts prices away from equilibrium, and the longer term pressure to return towards equilibrium is very, very powerful. So you mentioned our website, researchaffiliates.com. We have Asset Allocation Interactive as one of our tools, and it's a free tool. Ben Johnson from Morningstar once listed his seven favorite free websites, and this was one of them. It gives forward-looking expectations for return on 130 different markets. It uses that simple yield plus historical normal growth rates plus a small dose of mean reversion. It's inspired by Jeremy Grantham's work on long-term returns with a very important difference. Grantham assumed full mean reversion in 7 years. So the return assumption for U.S. equities has been negative for 13, 15 years. That's the tail wagging the dog. And I think relative valuations are powerful in the long run, but equilibrium relationships can change. There can be a new normal. And so let's assume maybe new normal, maybe return to historical norms, and let's assume that it can happen slowly. And if you do that, you wind up with some pretty good forecasts on long-term returns. So I don't have short-term views on whether the Mag 7 is going to beat international value stocks this year or next. I have a very strongly held view that for those who are patient with a 5 to 10 year horizon, the margin in favor of non-US value assets is going to be huge. If you get 1.5% from US growth stocks over 10 years, compounded out, that's about 16, 17% return. If you get 11 or 12% from non-US value over 10 years, that's tripling to quadrupling of your money.
So let me set the record straight, because you're 100% right, because I think long-term in big pictures, but I trade because I was a floor trader and I'm a currency trader and bond trader by nature. So I went and met with Jeffrey Bell and Lehman when they were working on a thing in 1995. And when they walked me to the elevator after 3 hours, and they said to me, plain and simple, you're destined for the insane asylum because you think in these massive long-term perspectives, but you're busy trying to trade it. And they were laughing. And then it re-rose itself with, you might know him, Steve Drobny. You must know the Drobny group because they were out of Southern California.
So I know the name, I don't know.
Well, so he wrote a book on global macro traders in 05, 06. And somebody told him about me, and he was Peter Thiel's in there. So let me, Besant is in there. So it's that group. But he came to talk to me. He said, I'm coming to Chicago, through Chicago. Let me stop and talk to you. So we wound up spending a day and a half with each other because he didn't really believe I existed, because you can't possibly make those two worlds merge. But I love it is hard. Yeah. I mean, it's, and people know me, know how whacked out I can be at times, but your points are, and especially in today's world, what you, and I'm going to promote you here, and I didn't mean to promote you, but because of the algorithms that are high speed searching for correlations, but the correlations are based on price activity.
Mm-hmm.
But correlations based on price activity without being supported by the underlying fundamentals, as we may see them in the long term, create a lot of volatility, but don't stay for a long time. So they actually, like, they provide me with opportunity on a day-to-day basis. They can also provide me with a lot of pain, but it doesn't change what may be underlying. And I'll lay one out that I'm looking at right now with what the tariffs. Okay, so let's say that Europe gets the same deal as Japan. Let's say that Trump provides them the same deal. And I'm looking at it from the way I'll analyze this in a longer term perspective, is that that massively favors Japan as long as the Euro-Yen cross is up at these elevated levels.
Right.
And because you're both going to get 15% tariffs on automobiles. Well, Germany is going to really struggle because they're going to be saddled with a very elevated euro, not necessarily against the dollar, everybody talks, but against the yen, because the yen has gone on a various role here. And a lot of it, I think, is with Ueda. And Ueda, in my mind, made some classic mistakes and cost Ishiba a lot of electoral support because inflation is way too high. Interest rates in Japan, regardless of the size of the debt, need to be higher. And that would have taken the yen higher.
Yeah.
And that's what the Japanese populace really were voting about, that they were being supplanted and caused a lot of financial grief by a weak yen. Those are ways that I think, but if I try to trade them way ahead of it, it's death.
Yeah.
It's death. So I love what you had to say. And that's, but in the world of algorithms now, it happens so much faster than we ever saw it. And that's the adjustment.
Yeah, that's one thing that is noteworthy. The markets making large shock moves, both at the micro level, meme stocks, and at the macro level, big market moves, are more common relative to the daily standard deviation than they used to be.
Yeah, I love that.
And that's noteworthy. The interest rates, I think Knut Wicksell is one of the most important overlooked economists. His notion of natural interest rate. I like I said, I liken it to a speed bump. If interest rates are below the rate of inflation, then you're lending money for free to those who are deemed creditworthy enough to get those rates. Innovation is risky. Innovation is speculative, and therefore innovation doesn't get money at those rates.
Right.
What does get money at those rates is stock buybacks for top quality companies and government spending. And if you can borrow for less than zero in real terms, you're going to borrow everything you can. Viewed from a natural interest rate perspective, the historical long-term average real short rate over the last 75 years, and of course it's pogoed wildly around this, but it's been about 1%, and long rates about 2%. So if we believe long-term inflation over the coming decade is going to be, let's say, 2.5, that would say short rates ought to be about 3.5, and long rates would probably settle in at about 4.5. To me, that's very simple logic. Now, I'm with you that Powell is a disaster. I he is surrounded by neo-Keynesians, and it is a consensus organization, but they talk about maintaining independence. How can you possibly say that the Fed is politically independent when it slashes rates 50 basis points on the eve of an election, and then doesn't cut rates at all in the aftermath of that election, because the guy you can't stand just won. I say that's the reason. I don't know that's the reason. Neo-Keynesians will come up with explanations of why their models tell them not to. But if the natural short-term rate is inflation plus one, or I should say long-term expected inflation plus one, then you're looking at 3.5. We're well above that. But, you know, there's ample room to take it down. I first developed utter disdain for Powell in 21 when he coined the expression transitory inflation. I was on record saying current fiscal and monetary policy in the wake of COVID is likely to trigger large inflation. Not guaranteed, but highly likely, especially if the policy leaders deny that possibility. If they deny that possibility, then it's more likely to happen. And lo and behold, 8 months after he coined the expression in March of 2021, the inflation rate over the prior 3 months had been 8% per annum. You had 2% in just 3 months with no sign of it slowing. Ouch. So I looked at that and thought, this is reckless. He's putting Fed credibility on the line. And 8 months later, he basically said, okay, let's forget transitory. It's not transitory. But we'll get it under control. At the time he said that, the Fed funds rate was 3/8. And the inflation rate had crossed 7. 8 months after that, inflation crested at 9. And the Fed funds rate was, most people guessed that it was already 3 or 4 when we hit peak inflation. No, it was 1 3/8. He was so far behind the curve. His hero ostensibly was Volcker. And when inflation hit 14.7, Volcker already had Fed funds at 19. Now that's somebody who's willing to take inflation seriously. When inflation's at 9 and Fed funds is at 1 3/8, you've got somebody who's utterly clueless at the helm. And when the economy is robust in an election year and you do a 50 basis point cut and you claim to be apolitical and independent, I call bullshit on that.
We weren't at that, and this is not to poke at Powell, because in 2018, I was actually, in the first few months of the year, I was in favor. I thought, wow, he's raising rates, he's doing quantitative tightening, but I thought going down and doing both of those at the same time was a gigantic mistake. What later Druckenmiller called the double shotgun approach was a mistake, because they had never been here before. They were treating it like they knew how to exit from this. Well, you can model it all you want. You've never been here, and you've changed the whole nature of the funding system, so you got a little too aggressive. But I agree with you, and I was writing a blog pretty regularly back in 2021, and I was criticizing, because all you heard from them is, we're going to keep rates at this level until everybody who lost a job through no fault of their own had their job back. And my criticism was, I don't want you to be the Minister of Social Justice.
Right.
I want you to be a central banker and worry about what you're supposed to worry about. But he didn't. He went down. So I think that criticism is totally justified. And if Trump was listening, I would say, you're going after him the wrong way, because I thought that Powell, by his own hand, should have resigned. And I'm not the only one. Lizzie Warren beat him up for the inside trading scandal at the Fed, which everybody seems to forget. Richard Clarida from your part of the world, guilty. Well, they were never tried, but you're the chair of an organization. Can you imagine if four board members of IBM were caught insider trading, the chairman's head would have absolutely been on the chopping block. This is your board. And so he had Rosengren, Kaplan, Bostic, but Bostic never paid a price, even though he was clear. So for that reason, Powell, by his own hand, should have resigned and said, look, there's things that have gone on here. And I said it then, and I'll say it now. That was reason. Whether I like you or not, I don't care who you were. And Volcker is I've been thinking a lot about this. In fact, I had a long conversation with a dear friend of mine who was a political economist with me in grad school the other day. Volcker had a different situation. Volcker had a monetary problem. Powell has had, because of Bernanke and Yellen, he's got a fiscal problem. And we haven't really gotten into this, but Volcker faced a 39% debt to GDP ratio.
Yeah, a fiscal problem encouraged by ZIRP.
Well, exactly. So he would never have gotten himself into that mess, but his hands were tied. But the Fed is absolutely bears the responsibility because they foamed the runway for QE, 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 and then not knowing, and every time they came close to trying to get out of it, they panicked. You know, who can forget May 2013, the famous temper tantrum. And Bernanke couldn't run away from what he was trying to do fast enough, which told you they don't know how this ends. They don't know
That's
how this
exactly
ends.
Right. This is the reliance on models. The Fed has a dual mandate, maintain stable purchasing power of the currency, maintain full employment. If you have a dual mandate, you're going to do both of them rather badly. If you add, by the way, let's make sure we don't have serious bear markets, third mandate. By the way, let's examine how monetary policy encourages global warming. Quadruple mandate. Now you're pretty much assured that you're going to do a horrible job on all four of them. And that's where we are. I think central banks should have one mandate, steady purchasing power of the currency. And steady purchasing power doesn't mean 2% plus or minus 2. Steady purchasing power means negligible inflation. People forget that in the Byzantine Empire, the Byzant had steady purchasing power for 625 years. So when people say you can't manage to a zero inflation target, I reject that out of hand. You can. And prior to Bernanke, all previous Fed chairmen, and it was all men at the time, took the view that zero was the target. Now they all missed the target to the upside because that's easier than to the downside. And yeah, I get it. If you have a plus 5 inflation rate, it will be disruptive. It will create complications. But if you have minus 5, it creates a horrible mess. I get that asymmetry. But the mandate should be a singular mandate. For the ECB, officially it is. For the JGB, officially it is. But, excuse me, BOJ. Officially it is. But in point of fact, they're almost all saying current purchasing power stability is 2%, which means once every generation and a half, you've lost half your purchasing power. They all throw in these additional mandates, whether officially as in the US or unofficially. And that's wrong. That's stupid.
You know, they love to throw out Volcker. Oh, you know, I remember Powell's finding his inner Volcker. It's nonsense because Volcker was opposed. You know, they all forget, but Volcker was opposed when he famously wrote that article when he went to New Zealand after, and with Donnie Flyfish, I believe with Donnie Bresch, who is credited with breaking the back of inflation in New Zealand by putting into place a 2% inflation target. And even Volcker in his book, his last book that he wrote, talks about it's insane. Because so if you're at 1.7 inflation, you're going to cut rates because you're under this target that you yourself have mandated yourself for. Yeah. And if you're, you know, so he said, no, you've got to be, there's got to be a little bit more subjectivity to central, you know, to central banking. You have to read certain things and go, no, that may not call for it. You're seeing other things. So, but again, you could take, you can abstract out whatever you want to justify yourself. And when I would add one more mandate for it, being the world's reserve currency. Mm-hmm. When things are tight globally, because there's 6-7 trillion of U.S. of dollar denominated debt around the world. So when the dollar gets too high, or interest rates get too high, and liquidity starts to get squeezed, now you have to open up swap lines to finance the rest of the world with the dollars that they need to meet their funding, to meet their borrowing requirements. So I always, that's always, there's one. So now we're up to 5 mandates.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Go ahead. The reserve currency thing as kind of a distraction, because the reserve currency is whatever the marketplace, the global trading community deems it to be. Basically, if 70% of all trade, international trade, settles in dollars, it's the reserve currency. And I don't agree with Summers on a lot of things, but when Summers said reserve currency status is not at risk, you've got Europe's a museum, Japan is a retirement home, or an old age home, and China's a prison. Who's going to trust those as reserve currencies? The BRICS put together this proposal to create their own shared currency, and people were all stressed, are the BRICS going to become the reserve currency and take it away from us? Give me a break. Are you going to want Putin and Xi and whoever's in charge at that particular year in South Africa and Brazil and India, you're going to trust them as the reserve currency? Give me a break. And the U.S. is not very trustworthy on policy stability, but it's a heck of a lot better than BRIC policy stability. So anyway, I don't worry about reserve currency issues.
But it is interesting that you bring that up, because you know, nobody asked him this question, and I got into it with a journalist a couple weeks ago about it in a private, because I won't do that publicly, but there is one. Nobody ever asked Powell about gold, and does he view gold's price as a problem? Because, you know, I look at gold, and to me, what it signifies in a fiat currency world is a statement about a central bank or monetary authority's credibility. That's what I look at it. And yeah. I can tell you that I know somebody who used to lunch with Volcker back in the days, in a job that he, in his position that he had, and Volcker would always ask about the price of gold to him. He was a markets guy.
Right.
And whether he said this as a quote or was the assumption, he viewed gold as his enemy. If gold was going up, he wasn't doing his job. And it was interesting when Sorkin on CNBC had that deal logic that he has, and he had Powell there maybe 6, 7, 8 months ago. And he asked Powell, somebody must have fed him the question, because he asked him, he says, do you have a view on gold? Do you think gold signifies anything? And Powell's response was more than interesting to me, because he said, well, he's used gold like he did, like he's used Bitcoin. It's a speculative element. Meanwhile, gold has been going up for 4 years on his watch. And certainly we can go back to what happened during 08, 09, 10, 11, but it was certainly going up. So he said that's the way he looked at it. And And I couldn't believe it. I was waiting for Sorkin to ask a follow-up question, but he didn't. And if that's what Powell believes, there's a problem. That's why he's no Volcker. End of story. You will never be a Volcker, because Volcker understood what the role of gold was in a fiat currency world.
Yeah.
If it's okay to ask one last question, Rob, on for next week, we have the quarterly refunding announcement, QRA, coming, speaking of rates and monetary policies. This is where U.S. Treasury tells the world how much issuance there will be and where it will take place along the yield curve. Just wondering if you have any thoughts on that, what could happen?
That falls squarely in the category of I'm a long-term investor. I've been with mild disinterest, except from the vantage point of if the announcement is a surprise, it will move markets and it will create opportunity. So I watch for whether the market is surprised. Not a very useful answer, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. And your thoughts, Ira, on that?
I'm in 100% agreement. The only thing I'll add to that is, the paper that they're quoting from Steve Marin, and of course, what's his name, who he wrote it with? They talked about how they would, how they criticized Yellen and Brainard for, with the T-bill view, and of course, they're staying that same course. If there's any change, and regardless of what Donald Trump thinks, you can cut rates. But that 10-year, because of your borrowing profile and your debt profile, could be over 5%. So you can be at 3.5% on overnight rates.
Yeah.
You can have that curve. And you can have the 210 curve out to 110, 120, which, by the way, is a historical average of it, maybe a little bit higher. So you're well under it. The amazing thing to me is that the United States, of all the major economies, has the flattest curve of anybody. We're at, on the 210, we're at 50 basis points. Germany's at 80. I got the list right in front of me because I look at it. It's a very important. And all those curves are much steeper. Japan, where's Japan at this morning? 75. So the United, which to me is mind-boggling. But whatever, I agree with him 100%. We'll see the way it comes. But I'll know what to do with it. Because again, I like the steepeners. I don't like them here per se. I'm not going to skate to the puck right now, but I have some better levels down where I'd like to buy a steepener at 25 to 30 basis points. That's the area I'm looking at. I'm not touting it. I'm just looking at it as a level because my job is to create the greatest opportunity with the least risk, and I really can't define it very well here, but I'm with him. But let's see what comes here. This is bigger than people think, though.
I would add one observation, and that is I think one of the biggest blunders monetary and borrowing policy blunders of Obama and first term Trump was not issuing 50 and 100 year debt when we could. It would have been a great service to future generations to borrow when we could at maybe 4% for 100 years to kind of box off that chunk of the debt and say, okay, let's let the next few several presidents in a row not have to worry about this chunk of debt.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, so one of the few times I agreed with Larry Summers outright, because Summers was pushing that and couldn't believe that they whether to do whatever you could do. As they say in the markets, when the ducks are quacking, you feed them.
Yeah.
If you could feed them with that, that was what you should have done. I agree totality.
Well, great. Fascinating discussion and insights. How can our listeners and viewers learn more about your work, Rob?
Just go to researchaffiliates.com. We publish, self-publish, typically about two papers a month on very diverse topics. We posted one just yesterday that looks at classic growth and value and challenges that binary duality where if it's growth, it's anti-value, and if it's value, it's anti-growth. Pardon me, value means cheap, growth means growth. Growth doesn't mean expensive. And if you redefine growth based on growth rates, instead of it's got to be expensive to be a growth stock, you wind up with a more powerful growth strategy. It's really quite remarkable.
Yeah, I highly recommend that. I'm on the mailing list also. And your thoughts, Ira, final thoughts? And
I couldn't agree more. And this is what I've been trying to teach people who I hear from who are now looking to get invested. Now, and I go, no, it's not what you do. You're chasing markets and you just now you're it's gotten to you where you can't take it anymore, which is when you're biting on your knuckle, I got to get in. Everybody's making all this money. They're seeing new cars or, you know, and they can't. I said, no. So, Rob, I am going to direct all these people because I said, you got to do some homework.
Yeah.
If you're going to just turn your money over to somebody, you're looking for trouble because Wall Street is built. All they care about is fees, and they're going to get them out of you one way or another. And I don't care how big you are. I've seen people worth hundreds of million dollars who are just as who are treated like plankton, like everybody else in the food world. So do your work so you can ask questions. You know, and I know that's what you're doing because you know you've been around long enough. And God, going back to the days when Barron's was worth a read. You know, I know that you were. Quite a bit, you know, so then it was really worth a read. But thank you for the time. This was really great for me. I enjoyed it.
Also, look at our Asset Allocation Interactive website.
I have it written down.
Yeah. It's gone viral by the standards of our industry. We have about 500,000 unique visitors per year at the website. And it has forward-looking returns on, like I said, over 150 asset classes. And it tells you how we came to that forward-looking return. And the whole goal is to get people away from the addiction of looking at recent past returns and chasing them and into looking at objectively measured likely future returns as a basis for investing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This has been great fun. Thanks.
Yeah, this has been fun. This is really
thanks, great. Rob, Ira, and Judd, if you can put up your contact details also. Thank you again, Rob, Ira, and Judd.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.